Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict holds his weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square, looking ahead to the events of the Easter Triduum, but also praying especially for all those affected by the devastating earthquakes in and around the central Italian city of Aquila. And looking back at the life and legacy of Archbishop Oscar Romero, we have a special report on a new season of hope for reconciliation in the Central American nation of El Salvador. The people of Aquila and the surrounding towns and villages were at the heart of Pope Benedict's prayers on Wednesday as he held his weekly general audience with the crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square. Hopes are now rapidly fading of finding more survivors from the first earthquake that hit the central Italian town on Monday, while a series of aftershocks are continuing to hamper rescue efforts and cause panic amongst the estimated 20,000 people who have been left homeless by the disaster. The death toll has risen to at least 250 victims, with over 100 more seriously injured. The first funerals took place outside the city on Wednesday, while a state funeral and national day of mourning is planned for Good Friday. Meanwhile, Pope Benedict himself announced he is hoping to visit the devastated area soon after Easter, as my colleague Charles Collins reports.
Cari fratelli e sorelle,
Pope Benedict on Wednesday told the people of L'Aquila he hopes to visit them as soon as he can, and that he shared their pain and worries. He was speaking during his weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square.
In primo luogo, rinnovo la mia vicinanza spirituale alla cara comunità dell'Aquila.
He renewed his spiritual closeness to the town and surrounding communities, which have been hardest hit by the violent earthquakes which began early Monday morning and have left over 200 people dead and thousands of others injured. The Pope drew attention to the prompt response of the civil authorities and volunteers to the disaster and said their work shows the importance of solidarity in overcoming these ordeals. He offered his prayers and asked for the mercy of the Lord on those who have died and the maternal comfort of Mary for the victims' families and for the survivors of the disaster. Before making his announcement, the Pope spoke about the three most sacred days of the calendar, the Triduum, which begins on Thursday.
Tomorrow we begin the Holy Triduum, the heart of the entire liturgical year, a time when we immerse ourselves in the central events of our redemption. The Christmas serves as a prelude to these 3 days, as priests renew their promises to the bishop, who then blesses the holy oils and consecrates the chrism, signifying the gift of the Holy Spirit. At the Mass of the Lord's Supper, we recall the institution of the Eucharist, the supreme sign of Christ's love for us. As we venerate his cross on Good Friday, we contemplate the full meaning of his words, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many." Holy Saturday finds us waiting in silent hope for the Easter vigil, when every church will break forth in a song of joy at the Lord's resurrection. The celebration of the Paschal mystery calls the depths of Christ's love. He did not wish to exercise his divinity as an exclusive possession, a means of domination, or a sign of distance between him and us. Rather, he emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, by sharing fully in our human condition, even to the point of death, not a death imposed by blind chance or fate, but one freely chosen in obedience to the Father's will for the salvation for all. May our fervent celebration of the Triduum draw us even more deeply into Christ's Paschal mystery.
Pope Benedict also greeted college students at the end of the audience. The students were participating in a program sponsored by Opus Dei, the UNIV.
Vi esorto a rispondere con gioia alla chiamata del Signore per dare un.
He encouraged the students to respond with joy to the call of the Lord in order to have a full sense of life in their studies, with their family, and in society. He then quoted point 755 of Opus Dei founder Saint Jose Maria Escriva's book, The Way, which says, "Don't forget, many great things depend on whether you and I live our lives as God wants." Meanwhile, a group of students from Africa have sent the Pope a letter thanking him for his apostolic voyage last month to Angola and Cameroon. The letter in particular thanked the Holy Father for what he said during the meeting with young people in Luanda. It said Pope Benedict understood the expectations, joys, fears, and sufferings of the continent of Africa. The signatories of the letter pledged themselves with all their power to transform Africa with patience and dedication and working for the good of future generations. For this, they said they were counting on the prayers of the Pope. I'm Charles Collins.
Thanks to Charles there for that report on Pope Benedict's weekly general audience. Holy Week in El Salvador is being celebrated this year with a renewed sense of hope for the church, still struggling to overcome the devastation of a civil war, which officially ended back in the early 1990s. The 12-year-long conflict was followed by over two decades of rule by the right-wing Arena Party, but last month's elections brought to power for the first time the left-wing FMLN Party, whose leader has pledged to work for peace and reconciliation, plus a better deal for the nation's poor. Significantly, the new leader, Mauricio Funes, who takes over as president in June, draws inspiration from the words and actions of the assassinated Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero, who was shot and killed on March 24, 1980, while saying Mass in the tiny chapel of the cancer hospice where he lived.
As his death grew closer, he knew he was going to die. He saw his spiritual director on the very day he died and said he wanted to be clean before he met God.
Former director of the English Catholic aid agency CAFOD, Julian Filikowski is also founder and chair of the Romero Trust, set up to promote greater awareness of the life and legacy of the assassinated Archbishop of San Salvador.
He today represents the essence of the option for the poor. He lived it, and he showed that the words were not some empty rhetoric of the last part of the 20th century, that they were something that could be lived. He was a martyr to the magisterium of the church because his work alongside the poor in support of human rights and social justice was all done on the basis of the gospel and Catholic social teaching, of which he was an expert and which he taught with great vigour and great energy throughout the 3 years he was Archbishop. So the justice and peace movements and reconciliation movements around the world see Oscar Romero as a kind of icon, an icon of holiness, an example. And there's great yearning across the world to see him beatified and canonised, because really we want him as a patron saint of our movements.
It's now nearly 30 years since his assassination, and as you say, many people already see him as an icon, a saint, and yet you're following closely his cause for beatification. Are we likely to see any progress there in the near future, do you think?
Well, that there is great, great hope that we will. We've just celebrated the 29th anniversary of his martyrdom. And next year, the 2010, is really a big year. It's a big anniversary. And I suppose what is being hoped for is that will be this year, a kind of jubilee year, will be the year which sees the beatification come to a conclusion. It completed long ago the stages in the Archdiocese. And indeed, Oscar Romero is servant of God. The process is here in Rome, and we are waiting for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith to give the next okay for it to go forward with the Congregation for the Saints. And thereafter, as a martyr, it should be not be a lengthy process.
You're talking about his option, his preferential option for the poor. And yet, in the wake of his death, there was a certain amount of division, even within the church, wasn't there, as to how much this preferential option for the poor should be embraced by the whole church. Tell us about the situation there today, the challenges facing the church in El Salvador today.
Well, the poor of El Salvador are poor, but the poorest people, or many of the poorest people, have left the country. It's a different economy. It's a different place. There's a huge number of Salvadorans who've emigrated to the United States and also to Mexico and other places nearby. And their remittances from their work, their very poorly paid work, usually, is the biggest element in the dollars earned by El Salvador today. So the poor are actually holding the country together financially in that way. And the land question is no longer so acute as it was in Archbishop Romero's time. And it's become a financial center in some other ways. There has been progress, but the poor are poor and they need a pastor who cares about them. The great thing for this year of this special year towards the 30th anniversary is I think it's a year of new beginnings in El Salvador in two ways. That in June, the new president will take office. And for the first time, he is not from the party whose founder planned Archbishop Romero's killing. It's not the Arena party. And the man is Mauricio Funes, was the candidate of the left, although he'd never been involved in the war and the guerrilla army himself. He was a journalist, a very popular journalist, a very, very much loved journalist, and greatly appreciated. And I think that's why he was elected. He has a great devotion himself to Archbishop Romero. During his election campaign, he very quietly went to Archbishop Romero's birthplace on his birthday, on Romero's birthday, Feast of the Assumption last year, to pay his respects. And in his victory announcement, he, again, in a very appropriate way, drew attention to Archbishop Romero, who would be a kind of symbol and sign of his administration that will be dedicated to the poor. So we hope that there will be a peaceful transition, that there will be reconciliation in the country, that it will bring about that final unity which has never really come since the end of the war 15 years ago, and that this will be a moment to do it if ideology doesn't get in the way of a national unity and that compassion for the poor. And interestingly, we've very recently had a new archbishop in San Salvador, Archbishop Escobar Alas, a young bishop, and who is speaking in a very different language from his predecessor about the poor and about the place the poor have in the life of the church, and his commitment to Archbishop Romero and his beatification. And I think it's really, in every sense for the poor, a moment of new beginning that this year can bring for them.
So a real step on the road to reconciliation, which, as you say, has plagued the country. The scars of this war, this devastating civil war, which affected so many, it really is perhaps drawing to a close.
Yes, I mean, I think it really is, in a world where there is so many people downcast, so many places where they're in mourning, I think in El Salvador it's a moment of hope and expectation. And we have to see how it works out, but with a goodwill and with the church working together with the new government and bringing the poor along and being active protagonists in processes of reform and change, it could be a great year. And El Salvador in November this year, of course, has another big anniversary, which is the 20th anniversary of the killing of the six Jesuits who gave their lives too for the people of El Salvador. So it's a bumper year, and it's a year which is characterized by great hope.
What was was it that first drew you to this cause with such passion? It's become really your life's work at the moment, hasn't it?
Well, I was very committed to human rights work in Latin America. In that work, I was very close to the Society of Jesus, who taught me in my secondary school in Great Britain. And through them, I got to know Archbishop Romero. And it's the greatest grace and privilege of my life to have worked with him. And I feel that his example is just so powerful at this juncture. He really is, hopefully, a saint for the 21st century. I think people admire him. He's used in diaconate training programs as a model. Confirmation classes ask for the material about him because they see him as a soldier for Jesus Christ in the very best sense of that word. And I think for the world around us, to be a Christian leader today, what we're looking for are people who are credible witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Oscar Romero is just utterly credible. He was a great, great witness to Jesus Christ. He was not a secularized bishop. He was not a populist bishop. He was a bishop with an immensely deep spirituality, a life of prayer. He made his decisions in contact with God. But he did it in absolute authentic fulfillment of the social teaching of the church. And as a man, he was loyal and author, as I said, an enthusiastic teacher of the church. But he also saw that the church was not just magister, it was matere magister. And so he was a wonderfully warm, encompassing, inclusive pastor. And he was really the beloved of the people there. And they cried, "We want bishops like Oscar Romero."
He was something of a reluctant leader, though, wasn't he? He didn't really fulfil this role until he was thrust into that position as archbishop there.
Oh, very much so. He's got a trajectory from his early priesthood where he was a great preacher. He had great oratorical skills. He was a great communicator. He was a journalist. He ran 3 dozen newspapers in different places he was. And he was very firm. And he was very committed to the poor. He gave all his belongings away when he was in San Miguel in the parishes. He used to have breakfast for the shoeshine boys. And he lived very, very simply. But that part was the kind of the hidden life. When he came to San Salvador, first of all, as an ecclesiastical bureaucrat, I think he was very disorientated and he lost his connection with the people at the grassroots. And he became really a very stuffy, haughty, pedantic ecclesiastical bureaucrat. And he was frightened by some of the things happening after the Council of Medellin and Vatican II. Not that he ever disowned them, but I think he had a midlife crisis. So people knew him at that time as someone who was a very defensive person and not someone who was embracing the Vatican II reforms. But we were wrong because the earlier Romero was the right one. So when he came to San Salvador, one has to recognise today, to the great dismay of the clergy and the people, it was a moment when he regained his balance and his equilibrium. He threw away those blue years of famine and became the pastor that he always was. And the killing within 2 weeks of his assuming office of Father Rutilio Grande, his friend, was a moment not of a Damascus moment when he was suddenly swiveled round at 180 degrees. It was a Gethsemane moment where, praying before his body, praying before his friend, he realised if he was to follow through what it would mean for him. And very soon afterwards, he wrote to one of the bishops in Latin America, "I think my new post has put me on the road to Calvary." And that was so prescient. And so he grew into the role. And the old, tetchy, impatient, slightly nasty bureaucrat, and people, we mustn't airbrush or whitewash that out of the history. That was that period was gone, and he actually during his 3 years went around to many of the communities when he was there. His first thing he did was to apologise for his behaviour when he'd been with them before, that he had not lived up to the teaching of the church in the way that he treated them, and he wanted to make up to them. And that readiness to say mea culpa, to be self-critical of himself and of his church in a loyal and immensely committed way, was what made him what he was. And his motto, which was right across his mitre, was sentire come ecclesia, to feel for, to palpitate with the church, taken from St. Ignatius' Exercises.
The people of El Salvador have already canonized him. Everywhere you go, you see posters and T-shirts for San Romero. So as far as they're concerned, they know he's in heaven. They know he's a saint.
Jan Grafius is curator of the Jesuit-inspired Stonyhurst College in the north of England. But recently, she too has been travelling to San Salvador to work on the restoration of relics, both of Archbishop Romero and of the six Jesuits murdered at the university there 20 years ago.
I went out first in 2007 to do a sort of an inspection visit to look and see what the problems were, to record and then to make recommendations. Went back again last year to implement some of the conservation work and carry out some of the recommendations. And I'm working with the Jesuits as they continue to devolve and evolve their plans for the displays in the university.
Both Romero's house and this room, as you say, dedicated to the memory of the slain Jesuits, have become places of pilgrimage almost, haven't they? What sort of people go there and what can they see? You mentioned vestments, but also other personal belongings. What exactly is on display there?
When you go to the house in the Hospitalito, it's largely as he would have left it, with a few exceptions, that the wardrobe front has been taken off and that's been glassed in, so you can see into his wardrobe, for instance. There's a glass door cutting off his bathroom, but you can see his toothbrush, the last roll of lavatory paper that was there, those sorts of things. So it's very much like walking into his house. Very, very simple. Three tiny little rooms, no carpets, no curtains, very, very plain. A single bed, a desk, the tape recorder where he recorded his daily diary, the typewriter where he wrote out his speeches, a few clothes, many, many books, and then in the back room, a glassed-in case where we've hung the alb, the chasuble, the trousers, the shirt that he was wearing when he was murdered, and a nun's habit from one of the sisters who was attending the mass at which he was killed, and she knelt down to help him, and her habit is soaked in his blood. That's lying in there as well. And it's quite extraordinary. While I was working there, of course, the sisters wanted to keep the rooms open. And people were coming in all the time, school children from El Salvador, lots and lots of children come. And with many of the poorest people, he's still very much a hero, a part of their lives. So country people would wander in, school groups would come in. Lots of visitors from America. And the American Episcopalian Church particularly has a very strong attachment to Oscar Romero. So I saw and met many Americans while I was there working. And in the university, the display, the Jesuits don't like to call it a museum. They're very keen that it shouldn't be seen as cultural artifacts. These are living testaments to what happened to these men. The objects are laid out in glass cases, but the groups are taken around by present-day students who speak either English or Spanish as required, and who give very moving, powerful stories that bring the objects alive. It's very well done.
You're handling, as you say, the very vestments that Romero was wearing at the moment that he was assassinated as he held up the host while he was saying Mass there. It must have been a very emotional experience, wasn't it?
It was probably the most terrifying thing I've ever done. I found it very difficult to pluck up the courage to take them down, and then once you start looking and working on them, your professional side kicks in, and you then just every now and then I just suddenly step back and think, goodness me, this is extraordinary. I'm actually handling these vestments that he was wearing, that they're literally soaked in his blood. Obviously, you wear cotton gloves to protect the objects from contamination from your own skin. But it's a strange mixture of a job that's very familiar to me and something that really is quite extraordinarily profoundly moving. I was a student when Romero was murdered, and at the time I was pondering my own faith journey. I was brought up as a Protestant and I became a Catholic shortly after, and I'm sure that the witness that Romero gave was such a powerful powerful one. It certainly helped me on that journey.
As you say, he is very deeply revered by many people still in El Salvador today. Of course, now a country at peace, and yet with many problems that continue to plague, particularly the poorest of the poor, for whom he was the voice, wasn't he?
Yes, very, very much so. It's a very beautiful country, but it's very troubled. And the murder rate nowadays is actually higher than it was during the Civil War, largely as a result of drugs and gangs. It's not a very safe place to be. It's a place where you have to be very careful where you go. And we met many, many very poor people. We went to Aguilares, where Father Rutilio Grande, the first Jesuit to be killed in El Salvador, and Oscar Romero's very close friend, where he was murdered, and met many people who just lived and worked in the surrounding areas, who would come. When they hear that you're connected with Oscar Romero, immediately people want to meet you and find out. And so many people thanked me for coming across to help preserve his relics. It was very, very moving. People would come out of little huts made out of corrugated iron with cakes and fruit juice, and they'd sit down and they'd want to talk to you. They have a huge respect for him and are hugely grateful to anyone who is interested in him from overseas, because it makes them feel that their own terribly sad story and their own struggle isn't forgotten, isn't unnoticed.
As you say, those struggles do go on. There's still a great need for reconciliation, isn't there?
Yes, very much so. I know that there have been elections in El Salvador, and the FMLN party, the party that was on the left and on the side of the guerrillas during the Civil War, has recently come into power, and the new president has said that he will take the works and the speeches of Oscar Romero as his guide. He's got a big job ahead of him. It'll be interesting to see how he gets on. But there is a huge divide still between the very wealthy in El Salvador and the very poor, and that's very obvious when you travel through the city from places where there are armed guards and large metal security gates into shanty towns where people are living in desperate, desperate poverty.
Great hopes that Romero may be beatified sometime soon. Do you think this will make a difference there in El Salvador?
Hugely, I think. I mean, the people of El Salvador have already canonized him. Everywhere you go, you see posters and T-shirts for San Romero. So as far as they're concerned, they know he's in heaven. They know he's a saint. But I think the feeling of solidarity it would give them with other people from outside the Central American sort of strife-torn area would be hugely important for them, a great sense of confidence and solidarity and other people respecting them and respecting Oscar Romero. I think it'd be very good for them, yes.
Jan Grafius, their curator at Stonyhurst College in the north of England. And earlier you heard the former director of the English Catholic Aid Agency, CAFOD, Julian Filikowski, who chairs the Romero Trust. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, if you can, for another edition of our English feature programme. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.